All right, go ahead and open up to 1 Timothy. Yet again. Tonight we'll be in chapter 5. And actually, I just had you open up to 1 Timothy. Before we look at our passage in 1 Timothy, turn back to the Old Testament, to Exodus chapter 22. I want us to, before we jump into the most thorough New Testament teaching on widows again, I want us to see something of God's heart for widows and others who were defenseless in the Old Testament. In Exodus 22, starting at verse 21, God's going to describe for us what he requires of his people and how they treat this group of people within the nation who had no resources, no help, no aid, no defense. No advocates, usually. Exodus chapter 22, starting at verse 21. Here's what God tells his people. You shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall not afflict any widow or orphan. If you afflict him at all, and if he does cry out to me, I will surely hear his cry, and my anger will be kindled, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall become widows, and your children fatherless. This is in the midst of God's law. He's just given the Ten Commandments. And as he starts to lay out some very basic laws that would be crucial to life in the land, he's preparing them to go into the land. In this passage, as well as in other Old Testament texts that we'll see in subsequent weeks, God cares deeply for this group of people. Widows, orphans, strangers, the poor. So much so, according to this text, that those orphans, those widows, those foreigners from outside of Israel naturally who would come in to be a part of God's people, who had not the same access, not the same resources, were really left with nothing being in the nation. He expected certain things of Israel. And what he just foundationally lays out here in what we just read is that those faithful people within Israel who cried out to him as a result of being oppressed, being taken advantage of because of their lack of aid and resources, God would actually set himself against those oppressors. And verse 24 says, he would kill them with the sword, and those oppressors, he would do the very thing to them that had happened to this group of oppressed people that they sought to take advantage of. You take advantage of widows, oppressive people, then I will leave your wives without a husband, making them widows. You take advantage of orphans, then I will make your children orphans by leaving them fatherless. And so God, here in this passage, at various places all throughout the Pentateuch, right, Genesis to Deuteronomy, makes it a point to his people to extend a certain kind of care and consideration to this group of people, orphans, widows, strangers. And so if God cares so thoroughly in the Old Testament for his people in this way, who find themselves without husbands, find themselves without fathers, then we should expect, as New Testament saints who worship the same God, to find similar thoughtfulness, a similar mindfulness of God for this group, namely widows. Fast forward to Acts chapter 6, which is the first time since the establishment of the church where you see this unique care for widows. Obviously, in the Gospels, Jesus condemns those who would take advantage of widows, who were devouring widows' houses, who were oppressing those same groups of people, strangers, widows, orphans in the New Testament, the religious leadership of Israel. He has strong words for them. But here, since he's established the church, what you have in chapter 6 of Acts, very early on in the church, in the life of the church, in a culture when widows are still being taken advantage of generally in the nation, here you have in this fledgling church in Jerusalem something else happening within the church now. Not, this isn't an issue of what's happening in Israel, just the broader culture, but this is specifically in the church. Widows are being taken advantage of here. And this is just one of the many potential obstacles to gospel advancement that's happening, or that's even happened so far. You had Jesus leaving, says, wait in Jerusalem. Various nations come together on the day of Pentecost. Language proves to not be a barrier. The apostles speak in tongues. 3,000 people are saved. They are sharing their resources so that there is no one needy among them. Chapter 2 says, and so even various lack of resources is not an obstacle to the gospel going forward. Chapter 3, physical infirmities prove to not be a barrier to the gospel being heard. They actually become a platform for the gospel being heard. Chapters 3 and 4, persecution against the apostles happens from the same people who killed Jesus. That proves to not be an obstacle. Insincerity within the midst of the congregation, chapter 5, with Ananias and Sapphira, comes up. They're lying, they're impersonating the true generosity that's being practiced in the church. They're being hypocritical. That becomes a potential roadblock to the advancement of the gospel, but again, by the end of that chapter, that proves to not be a true obstacle to the gospel. And then chapter 6, verse 1. Now at this time, while the disciples were increasing in number, a complaint arose on the part of the Hellenistic Jews against the native Hebrews because their widows were being overlooked in the daily serving of food. So here you have some sort of system within the church for food to be distributed to needy widows. They have no other means, and so the church is providing for them out of the resources of the other members of the congregation. And the Hellenistic Jews, who were widows, who the Hellenistic Jews would have been those Jews who had embraced Roman culture. They would have embraced the Greek language, specific distinctives of Roman culture at the time. And so they were viewed not as pure as the Hebrews, who didn't embrace those things, still knew the Hebrew dialect very well, those kinds of things. And so this faction that arose between them resulted in the more pure Hebrews denying the Hellenistic widows food. That was the issue. That was the faction. This would have, if it continued, proven to be an obstacle to gospel advancement. If this would have gone on long enough, then the same charge that Jesus leveled against the Pharisees for their oppression and mistreatment of widows, you could have gone out into Israel, into the temple, and seen that kind of oppression happening against widows. And then even if you look inside the church, spent time among the church who claimed to be called out from that, you could have, if this kept happening, been seeing the same thing happening in the church. And so the distinction that the gospel intended to make, even in producing these good works for one another within the congregation, would have been lost, and the church would have ended up looking very much like the world, the unbelievers who had crucified Jesus. The church who proclaimed that Jesus rose and that they had repented of some of them even participating in the crucifixion of Jesus would have ended up looking just like Jesus' murderers, which is obviously a huge problem. This was so much an issue that in verse 2, the 12 summoned the congregation of the disciples and said, "It is not desirable for us," the 12, "to neglect the word of God in order to serve tables." Not that this doesn't need to be addressed, but the apostles, God's commissioned the apostles, prototype elders, pastors, if you will, to do one thing, which if they would have stopped doing what they were required to do, committing themselves to the ministry of the word and prayer, to serve tables, that would have detracted from the gospel. So their conclusion is verse 3, "Therefore, brethren, select from among you 7 men of good reputation, full of the Spirit and of wisdom, whom we may put in charge of this task. But we will devote ourselves to prayer and the ministry of the word." The statement found approval with the whole congregation, and they chose Stephen, a man full of faith and of the Holy Spirit, and Philip, Prochorus, Nicanor, Timon, Parmenas, and Nicholas, a proselyte from Antioch. And these they brought before the apostles, and after praying, they laid their hands on them. And so they commissioned them to go address this budding faction in the church. Those 7 men get there. They serve faithfully. We don't see this being a problem anymore. All the widows, Hellenistic and Hebrew alike, are provided for. And so what the church did with widows, even in the early stages, mattered greatly. It would reflect on their ability to preach the gospel, to live consistently with the gospel message that they were preaching. So if we fast forward again to 1 Timothy 5, our text for tonight, what we find is the same concern, a similar emphasis on what the church does with widows, because if you remember, what's the purpose of 1 Timothy? What's Paul doing with 1 Timothy as he writes to his disciple, pastoring in Ephesus? Something having to do with piety? Paul's writing to Timothy so that Timothy could shepherd the church to what?
"The aim of our charge is love that issues from a pure heart and good conscience and sincere faith."
Yeah. And the way we've been summarizing that is practice piety-produced love. The church must practice piety-produced love. and it's Pastor Timothy and his other elders who are supposed to be leading the charge, guiding the church into how to do this well. The church must love, particularly and especially one another. The church must love, but not just any kind of love, because chapter 1, verse 5 says, the goal of our charge, the aim of our charge is love, but from a pure heart, a good conscience, and a sincere faith. Pure heart, good conscience, sincere faith. We're summarizing that with the term piety. Piety, true holiness on the inside, right? Your faith, your heart, your conscience, those are things that cannot be seen. But if it's pure, good, and sincere, if purity, goodness, and sincerity are dwelling there, then from that pious life, the church will effectively love one another. And so as we parachute back down into chapter 5, what the church does with widows is not separate from that ultimate aim. Love from a pure heart, a good conscience, and sincere faith. What Grace Bible Church does with widows and how we care for widows is not separate from our pursuit of loving from a pious inner life. So just to bring us back up to speed, this text, we'll start again at verse 3. Here's the leading command from which the instructions all the way through verse 16 flow. Verse 3, chapter 5, honor widows. Honor widows. Not just any widow, but honor widows who are widows indeed. But if any widow has children or grandchildren, they must first learn to practice piety in regard to their own family and to make some return to their parents. For this is acceptable in the sight of God. Now, she who is a widow indeed and who has been left alone has fixed her hope on God and continues in entreaties and prayers night and day. But she who gives herself to wanton pleasure is dead even while she lives. Prescribe these things as well, so that they may be above reproach. But if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. That's our text for tonight. Verses 3 to 8, we discussed specifically verse 4 last time and just got to talk a lot about how even you as young adults should be thinking about your obligation to your parents. What we'll see in just as a whole in verses 3 to 8 tonight is two components essential to honoring widows. Two components essential to honoring widows. Honor widows who are widows indeed, or truly widows. That means that these are women who have not only lost a husband, they're not just women whose husbands have died, but they actually fit a more specific category of women without husbands. Okay? So that's why the adjective there, indeed or truly widows, is given. Widows who are truly widows. They fit the criteria of what you ought to be thinking about when you think about widows. And these two components are essential to honoring widows. First, the dependence of widows. The dependence of widows. It is incumbent on the church to be able to accurately identify whether or not a widow is truly dependent. If the church fails at this point, then the church won't effectively be able to care for widows, or to use Paul's terms, honor widows. If the church can't accurately discern the dependence of widows. And this is what verses 5 and 6 show us, is the dependence of widows. It describes the dependence of widows. In this description, we have a few things, and these are things that are Paul's giving the criteria. When you think about a widow who needs to be honored by the church in a specific way, and we'll get to filling out what else is included in that honor in the last section. But honoring widows, who are widows indeed, verse 5 says, includes this. A widow who is a widow indeed is one who has been left alone, has fixed her hope on God, and continues in entreaties and prayers night and day. That is a succinct description of a widow who is a widow indeed. A widow who's a widow indeed fits this description. In essence, this woman remains completely alone, which, you know, if we back up just to verse 4, that means she has no children or grandchildren or family to care for her. She's truly alone. There's no other person with a natural obligation to her on earth, at least who's willing to care for her. She's alone. Now, she who is a widow indeed and who has been left alone. Next, this woman who's been left alone relies on God alone. She remains completely alone and she relies on God alone, which is the next phrase, has fixed her hope on God. The phrase that she's fixed her hope on God is a further description of what it means for her to have been left all alone. The only hope she has, the only option that she has is if God provides for her. If God doesn't provide for her, then she won't be provided for. She's lost. Right? There's no temporal means of provision for her. She is completely looking to the Lord, and that's her only option. So she's fixed her hope on God, and we shouldn't miss that even when a widow ran out of options, a widow didn't have to fix her hope on God. She didn't have to turn to God alone to look for provision, right? You think of times when God's people were completely out of resources due to famine, if you're Ruth and Naomi, in a foreign land, Ruth and Naomi, during a siege, right? People are without food. The Israel at various times, multiple times, had armies come against them for so long a period of time that they ran out of food in the walled city. And it was a part of the battle strategy to starve the people in the city out until they surrendered. Times when widows, God miraculously provided oil, right, during the time of the prophets for certain widows. That's the description of someone who has no other means, but they fixed their hope on God. So this woman is apparently possesses the godliness to not resort to any other way of providing for herself that would have been disapproved by God. She's going to rely on God at the risk of starvation. She's not going to resort to cheating or underhanded means, but she's actually looking to God to provide her very next meal. Which then gives us the last phrase, leads naturally into the last phrase, and continues in entreaties and prayers night and day. Literally, continues in the entreaties and the prayers night and day. A reference to specific requests, specific supplications, prayers that she's offering. And it's probably best to understand those entreaties and prayers as having to do with her being a widow. She does not have. And so the prayers, the entreaties that she's offering to God are for the provisions that she would need as a widow. And so this woman remains completely alone. She relies on God alone. And she resorts to prayer alone. She's wholly dependent on the Lord. This is the kind of woman who would need her prayers answered, whom God would be pleased to answer those prayers specifically through the church, as we'll see later. That succinct description in verse 5 is contrasted with the opposite in verse 6. So the dependence of the widow, we get a description in verse 5, and then we get the opposite in verse 6. But she who gives herself to wanton pleasure is dead even while she lives. This woman, what's being described here, is not someone who has fixed their hope on God, who continues in prayers night and day, looking to God alone for their provision. But she's actually self-serving in some way, right? Apparently, this was enough of an issue with women whose husband had died, who had no more obligations to the home and to the family to live for themselves, for Paul to actually address it here and give Timothy the contrast. This woman gives herself to wanton pleasure, is literally dead. She has died living. She has died living. Yes, she is physically still alive, but due to her obsession with just pleasing herself, with living for herself, this woman's practically dead. She's useless. The life she's chosen, now that she has no family obligations, is to please herself. That's actually an interesting commentary by Paul on the meaning of life, if you will, in what thing life consists, in a very unexpected place. If he's calling a woman who lives for her own pleasure dead while living, then that means life does not consist in hedonism, right? In pleasing self. Those who are hedonistic in their pursuits, hedonistic in their appetites, live to please themselves. The, you know, what I spend money on is about pleasing me. How I spend my time is what pleases me. How much I sleep or don't sleep revolves around me being pleased, right? I'm not staying up late for the good of others. I'm not going to bed early even for the good of others. My life is completely self-absorbed. As you think about what Paul is teaching, remember, this whole letter is written specifically to Timothy for the benefit of the church as they would have heard it. But as Paul is teaching this, this is actually really instructive for the rest of the congregation and for us. As you think, ladies, right? Most of you unmarried. How should this inform you and even instruct you currently as a single lady? What is your life consist of? Is it living for self? Do you serve? Do you serve eagerly? Do you have eyes to serve? Do you see needs? Are you prone to recognize needs and go meet them? The way you spend your money, is it for the good of others? Do you find yourself restricted in your purchasing ability because you give for others so much? The way you spend your time, if someone were to pull up your calendar, hey, what's on your calendar 2 weeks ago to 2 weeks forward? Has your time been spent doing what pleases you, or have you scheduled intentionally? Do you practice filling your time with encouraging others, building others up, giving of yourself for others? Emma's not here, but Emma babysits our kids once a month, at least. Never ask for anything, but she loves to do it. Our kids enjoy her, so she serves us in that way. Usually it's on elder care group nights, so the elders are served. We get to go be with the elders, be refreshed. The husbands and wives get to hang out together because she's sacrificing of her time for us, right? And I know some others of you do practice babysitting. It's a great way to serve the families in this church. Call up a family. Call up your favorite family or a family who you see, man. I wonder when the last time they've had a date night. Call them up and say, I want to give you and your husband a date night. When can I make that happen? My phone number is 504. Just kidding. Kind of. Unless you call me, unless you ask. But you think of, you know, setting yourself on that trajectory early, right? Even in the church, noticing what needs are there on Sundays. Lots of needs on Sundays. Lots of needs outside of Sundays. And not only single ladies, but single people have time to meet needs that married couples don't have, right? Seek to be meeting them. The young person, particularly woman, who practices this now early is setting herself on a course to, when she's, you know, in 40 years, when she's old enough to make the roll, make the list, as we'll see. You got to be above 60, Paul said. But if you practice those things now, you're setting yourself up on a course to be the kind of woman who would be such an asset to the church that the church would be eager to support you. And it's sort of like the women who Paul goes on to describe. I mean, you read in verses 9 and following in particular, the kind of woman this is. You know, women can't be elders, but if they could, she would be one. She's so godly, so pious, so essential to the body life of the church. She washes the feet of the saints, right? So she's been serving the saints. She's an asset because she's already raised children. She can instruct younger women. She shows hospitality to strangers. So she's opening up her home and using her resources for the good of the church and gospel ministry. She's assisted those in distress, even been a safe haven of sorts for the afflicted, a means of strength for them. She's devoted herself to every good work. Man, of course the church is going to do whatever we need to keep her around, right? As you think about being useful to the church, don't just think about now, but think in, you know, 60 years when I'm a widow, possibly. What am I doing now to train myself in usefulness then? That's the kind of woman who's being described, not one, verse 6, who, as one translator, one commentator translated it, lives deliciously. I like our translation. Don't live deliciously, women. Don't live for wanton pleasure. If you do, you're dead while living. The same principle, though it's applied specifically to widows in this context, could be said of men. Don't live for your own pleasure in ways that are purely and primarily self-serving. Verses 7 and 8 give us the second essential component to honoring widows. The church cannot compromise on this component if it's going to honor widows the way God requires, and that is the duty of the shepherd. The duty of the shepherd. The first essential component was the dependence of the widow. That needs to be accurately discerned. And also, what cannot be foregone is the duty of the shepherd. Verses 7 and 8, prescribe these things or command these things. We've seen that word used before in chapter 4. Verse 11, chapter 4, prescribe these things. So this isn't the first time that Paul is saying, listen, Timothy, you've got to not suggest these things, not recommend these things, not organize a focus group within the church so you can discuss these things. You got, as the pastor, with the full authority of God's word, require these things, command these things. This is the pastor's duty. What things are in view? Well, it's the very things that he's been discussing, having to do with honoring widows. Namely, children must care for widows. Timothy, you got to command that. Require it of the church members that any of them that have widows, command them to take care of their family. That's children. Verse 4, or grandchildren. They're obligated, so you command them to do this. That's the first godly practice. Children must care for widows. The second godly practice that the pastor must command is that widows must hope in God. And we just saw that in verse 5. Command the widows to hope in God. And even as you think about now, you don't know when you're going to be a widow, if you're going to be a widow. We have young widows in our congregation, have had young widows. It's not common, thankfully, but it happens. They were taught before they were widows to hope in God, to trust the Lord, so that by the time they became widows unexpectedly, they were continuing to practice hoping in God. So command that, Timothy. Command that, pastor. Children, care for widows. Also, widows, hope in God. Also, widows must not be hedonists. Just like we just saw, don't live for self-pleasure. Don't live to gratify yourself. Make your entire life about the glory of God and the good of others. And pour yourself out for that. Go to bed tired at night because you've been so busy pouring yourself out for the good of others. That is good if you find yourself exhausted at the end of the day from serving. That's a testimony that you're a good slave of Jesus. And also, the fourth godly purpose, number 4, you've got those godly practices, but also the duty of the pastor would include what we read at the end of verse 7. This godly purpose, so that they, that is the members of the congregation, may be above reproach. Interesting. That is the same character qualification that was required of elders, chapter 3, verse 2. An overseer, a bishop, a pastor, a shepherd, must be above reproach. That's not unique to elders, though. It's not the unique obligation of elders only to be above reproach. You must be above reproach if you're going to be an elder, if you're going to hold the office. But also, this is the requirement, as we see in verse 7, of the entire congregation. And something that Timothy was to command was all of these things so that the church would be above reproach. And that sort of brings us back full circle to what we saw first about widows. God's character and God's truth depended, in the sense that they were upheld, the upholding of God's character and truth were dependent on what his people did with widows. It's always been that way. When his people oppressed widows, they looked like the nation around them in the Old Testament. And so the nations, instead of doing what Deuteronomy 4 describes, wow, look how wise this people is. There's not a nation on earth that has such upright laws. And look at the way their society just runs because they obey the Lord. The nations were supposed to come into Israel, look in, and get a glimpse of God's marvelous wisdom and justice and righteousness and generosity. And instead, because they oppressed widows and orphans and strangers, there was nothing to look at in Israel. Same thing in the New Testament. That was going on. And if the church were not to care for widows, if the members of the church, you think about Christians not caring for their parents, having nothing to do with their parents, even though their parents are ailing, sick, not sacrificing to be able to care for their parents, then the Christian and then the church corporately looks no different than the world. And as we'll see in verse 8, they actually look worse than the world, because this is something that's natural among mankind, generally speaking. I mean, even the world, there are certain sins, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 5, you're practicing a certain kind of immorality that's not even practiced among unbelievers. Right? Referring to incest in that context. But this would be one of them as well. Man, you won't even care for your parents? An unbeliever could say that. What? What's wrong with you? And so that's also a part of the pastor's duty. Not only those general instructions for the church, but also specific instructions for families. Verse 8, but if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith. And not only has he denied the faith, but he's worse than an unbeliever. The person who claims Christ but refuses to care for their own family, that person is worse than an unbeliever. You've denied what you profess. By your works, you've denied what you profess, denied the gospel. And beyond that, you're worse than most natural men. It's helpful because of the context. This is a specific reference to caring for widows. Obviously, he's like still talking about that, right? But notice that Paul is even here careful in his words, that he doesn't say, if anyone does not care for his widows, right, or widows. But if anyone does not provide for his own, and especially those of his household. So this is, he's actually broadening the category to include the discussion he's been having about widows, but is making a point even more broadly that anybody who doesn't care for his own, that would include widows, other family members, siblings, if the opportunity presented itself, extended family, right? That would be your own. And then he says more specifically, especially of his own household, that would be members living under the same roof, considered family. Then he says, you've denied the faith and you're worse than an unbeliever. William Plummer says, no one was ever a loser by doing his duty to his parents. No one was ever a loser doing his duty to his parents. Because that could be hard, right? You think about ailing family members, the strain that that puts on a normal family life with husband, wife, children, and then you add, that just takes time, energy, effort, resources, finances. Even those things where it requires sacrifice, doing your duty, you're not losing in that. And it shouldn't be looked at as a burden to be endured. But this is a duty to be eagerly pursued, right? To not do that means that you're denying the very gospel that you claim. And so in this way, you remember from chapter 3, verse 15. Just turn back there for a second. Chapter 3, verses 14 and 15. Paul says, I am writing these things to you, Timothy, hoping to come to you before long. But in case I am delayed, I write so that you will know how one ought to conduct himself in the household of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and support of the truth. We've said, as goes the church, so goes God's truth. So goes God's reputation. When it comes to widows, how the Christian treats widows, how the Christian treats his own mother or grandmother who has no husband, and how the church corporately, as we'll see next time, cares for those widows without family, is directly proportionate to our ability to uphold the truth in God's reputation. If we fail at this, even as Grace Bible Church, you know, here we are, 21st century. If we fail at this, then we will be a poor representation of God's name, that we serve the living God. No one should believe us, right? If we fail at this. And the Christian who claims Christ brings doubt on his own profession if he doesn't practice this. And so this should be another opportunity for, all of us really, to think about how we're even considering caring for our family, caring for our parents in the future, should the opportunity arise. What provisions are you making now to set yourself up to care well for them? That could extend to something like picking a career wisely. That could mean spending resources currently wisely for whatever the future might hold. Saving, owning a home could be helpful. Those kinds of things. Not that their ultimate solutions are commanded by God, right? Paul doesn't outline the specific ways family has to be cared for. But just to even get the wheels turning in that direction, to say, man, yeah, I am going to have to probably provide for my family one day. What's that going to look like? Am I even thinking, training my heart to be willing and eager when that time comes? That's a good habit for us to get into. It's never too early, looking at a passage like this, to start considering those things. You guys have any questions before we close?
What does it look like for
Christians
to hear, you know, with widows? Because I mean, they women can work now, so like,
Yeah, we'll see a little bit about the details that Paul gives in the next section, so 9 and following. But there's lots of requirements before the church supports a widow. One of the things that's given here is her age. And this is presumably she's beyond working age, right? A widow who is of working age should work, right? Before being supported by the church. Cameron Dodd's an excellent example of that. She works. She provides for herself because she's able. And then the resources that the church has, if and when the opportunity arises, can be given to those who are widows indeed.
So I know that it talks about caring for family, but just to clarify, like, say there's a relative who's just really belligerent and wants nothing to do with you and is just kind of creating their own ruin. We're not completely responsible for them so far as they're allowing us, because they're kind of like the dead while she lives. Is that true?
Yep. The you know, you can't force them to let you care for them, yeah. Right? I think I have family members who, if they were in need, wouldn't let me care for them.
Yeah.
But certainly as a testimony to your genuineness and your sincerity, right, between what you profess and what you practice, mm-hmm. the willingness to care for them should be there. Yeah, that's sad.
I just wanted to get that clarification.
Yeah. At some point, I'd love to think a lot more, study a little bit more about the difference culturally between what we read about in the first century and former times to now. Because it just seems that it was a lot shorter road to somebody being without hope, you know, without any means. I started to think about this a little bit more with just thinking through the welfare state and government help. Some of those things, some of the ways that our government assumes the responsibility of caring for people removes the burden from family, which I don't think is helpful or biblical. Because you can feel like, well, they're fine. They've got Social Security, welfare, lots of, you know, government help. What do you need kids for? And then, I mean, by the vice versa, kids can feel the same way as I got lots of resources that I can leverage from social programs and stuff that I don't need family either. So it's just interesting to think, you know, a little more about the way our nation's structured economically, or has been at least for several decades, and the impact that that has on the dependence of family members on each other. Okay. That's for another time. It's just my musings. Yeah, Bree.
For verse 6, when it says, but she who is self-indulgent is it even while she lives. My question is I know you kind of already touched base on it, but I wasn't sure. Does that talk about like spiritual deadness and also physical deadness of like, if she is self-indulgent, then the church isn't going to care for her, so she is going to die, or is it like solely spiritual? Wasn't sure.
So that's a great question. What would happen to the widow who wasn't the kind of woman described here? I'm not sure, right? Who wasn't going to be supported full-time by the church. But the reference in verse 6 at least, is not to spiritual. but just a something that is what's the term I'm thinking of? It's idiomatic. It's like you've died living, meaning you've become useless, of no usefulness, no true life, because of the way you've chosen to live. I don't think it's a commentary on salvation, although it might prove itself to be true if a woman lived this way. But I think that just simply the point that Paul's making is a woman who gives herself to pleasure has essentially is not truly living so long as she does that. I don't know if that's helpful.